The following program is made possible with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Twameva Mata cha Pita Twameva Twameva Bandhu cha Sakha Twameva Twameva Vidya Dravinam Twameva Twameva Sarvam Mama Deva Deva.
In India, things never do really change. What one imagines is change has always been there in the past. And if it comes in the future, if there's any change in the future, it becomes absorbed into the past. I think in India, what one notices is the inclusiveness of life. How everything is included and becomes absorbed in the same pattern that's always existed.
Passages to India, a series created by Julian Crandall Hullick. In the West, the past is something to be categorized, labeled, and filed away as history. Americans live in the present and for the future. The past is stale, dusty, something to be remembered only on holidays. It's today that counts. Today's obviously better than yesterday, and tomorrow's bound to be even better. That's certainly the American view. But in India, ideas about the past and about time itself are very different. The West's neat divisions into past, present, and future are basically alien to the Indian mind. Most Indians consciously call on the past to help them deal with the present and fashion their future. Our program is called The Presence of the Past.
Our past does not live simply in our ruins. Our past is within us. It is within me. When I chant my Vedic mantras, I have a link with the past. The past lives in my psyche. The past is not dead. The Westerners tend to look upon the dead past, and therefore it fits in beautifully with their way of thinking. There's an old ruin, a dead past, fine. There is a past, you look at it and you come away. That's not the way we look at our past.
Your concept of time is different from ours. Yours is one vertical line, a beginning and an end, and day of judgment and whatever. The Hindu view is cyclical. There is no beginning or end. It's a continuous cycle. You are born, you die, and you're reborn into some other form. So the cycle goes on forever. It makes more sense to the Hindu, and most of them are absolutely convinced they are right and the Judaic religions are wrong.
I think there are many civilizations which have this idea of time not being linear, being either circular or like a spiral. I read, for example, that the Chinese think of time as being a ladder that you descend, so that tomorrow is one step below you. You descend into the future rather than rise into it. I think the linear aspect is not one which many civilizations would agree to or take seriously. Most of us see time as either a circle or a spiral.
I suppose we do take time for granted. Hands on a clock, digits on a watch. In a young country like the United States, it's the future that counts. History is awfully boring, anachronistic really, almost anti-American. I don't think we relate to the notion of thousands or even millions of years of human existence. Maybe two or three generations at most. But Indians always seem to have been very much aware of the scale of time, and to have seen it as somehow inextricably linked with the idea of India itself.
There was neither non-existence nor existence there. There was neither the realm of space nor the sky which is beyond. What stirred? Where? In whose protection? Was there water bottomlessly deep? There was neither death nor immortality then. There was no distinguishing sign of night nor of day. That one breathed, windless, by its own impulse. Other than that, there was nothing beyond.
This creation hymn from the Rig Veda is maybe 3,000 years old. Whoever wrote it seems to have known Genesis and Big Bang Theory. They're both there, subtle, ambiguous. What was the author thinking? Whence we came? How we came? Maybe even why we came?
Who really knows? Who will here proclaim it? Whence was it produced? Whence is this creation? The gods came afterwards with the creation of this universe. Who then knows whence it has arisen? Whence this creation has arisen? Perhaps it formed itself, or perhaps it did not. The one who looks down on it in the highest heaven, only he knows, or perhaps even he does not know.
For Indians, the idea of Bharat, of Mother India, is synonymous with the creation of the universe. That's like Americans dating the founding of the nation to Adam and Eve. So it's not surprising that Indians have a rather different sense of time from ours. Indians love to explain complex philosophical ideas in stories or myths that are easily understood by everyone. One of the best known that deals with time is the story of the great god Indra and the ants.
Indra, the king of the gods, decided to build himself a palace that would be more splendid than any other in the city of the gods. As work progressed, Indra became more and more demanding. His imagination took over, and what he wanted built became more and more impossible to achieve. His architect finally had enough and went to see Brahma, the creator, to ask for help. Brahma comforted him.
The problem will soon be resolved. Go back home and relax.
Brahma went to see Vishnu, the supreme being, who was reclining in the coils of his serpent. Vishnu listened in silence, said nothing. With a nod of his head, Vishnu let it be known that the architect's request would be fulfilled. Early next morning, a Brahmin boy carrying a pilgrim staff knocked at the gate of Indra's palace and asked to speak with the king. He was led into Indra's presence.
Why have you come to see me?
The boy replied in a voice that was as deep and soft as the low thunder of approaching rain clouds.
O king of the gods, I have heard about the mighty palace you are building. How many years will it take to finish such a magnificent palace? What further miracles of engineering do you expect your architect to have to perform? O highest of all the gods, no other Indra before you has ever succeeded in building such a palace as yours will be.
Tell me, child, are they then so very many, the Indras whom you have seen, or at least whom you have heard of?
Yes, I've seen many previous Indras.
The boy's voice was as warm and sweet as fresh milk, but the words sent a slow chill through Indra's veins. The boy continued.
My dear child, I knew your father Kashyapa, lord of all the creatures of the earth. I knew your grandfather Marichi, and I knew Brahma, and I knew Vishnu, the supreme being. I have witnessed the dreadful dissolution of the universe. I have seen all perish again and again at the end of every cycle. At that time, every single atom dissolves into the primal, pure waters from where everything originally came. Everything goes back into the bottomless, wild infinity of the ocean, covered in total darkness and devoid of all human life. I've lost count of the numbers of universes that have come and gone, each with its own Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, and each with its own Indra, king of the gods. There are so many who believe you can count all the grains of sand in the world and all the drops of rain that fall from the sky. but no one can ever count all the Indras that have come and gone.
Just then, a procession of ants appeared in the hall, marching in ranks 4 yards wide. The boy suddenly laughed, then fell into thoughtful silence.
Why do you laugh? Who are you, mysterious being, who comes here disguised as a boy?
I laughed because of the ants, because of the secret that they hold.
O son of a Brahmin, I don't know who you are. You seem to be wisdom incarnate. Please tell me this secret.
I saw the ants, Indra, filing past. Each of them was once an Indra. Each one became king of the gods thanks to their pious and good deeds. But now each of them, through many rebirths, has become an ant again. This army is an army of former Indras. If you are pious and perform good deeds on this earth, you will reach the kingdom of the supreme gods, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. But if you are evil, you will sink under the weight of your own misdeeds and be reborn as a rat or an insect. It's by your deeds that you become a prince or an Indra or a pig or an ant. That is the secret of life.
Indra was stunned by the boy's words. But before he had time to answer, a hermit entered the hall dressed only in a loincloth. On his chest there was a circular cluster of hair, intact at the rim but bald in the center as though many hairs had been plucked out. Indra remembered his duties as host and offered the visitor refreshments. The boy then began to question the hermit.
Who are you, old man? And what is the meaning of this circle of hair on your chest? And why is the center bare?
I am a Brahmin, and my name is Hari. I have no home, no wife, and no work. I have come to look at Indra. As for the circle of hair on my chest, with the death of one Indra, one hair falls off. That's why the center is bare. When all the hairs have fallen out, then the present Brahma will die. Each flicker of the eyelids of Vishnu registers the lifetime of a Brahma. Lord Shiva taught me this wisdom.
And with that, the old man stopped talking and suddenly vanished. At the same moment, the boy also disappeared. Amazed, Indra realized that the hermit had been Shiva and the boy Vishnu, and that it would be pure folly to continue work on his palace. He decided then and there to abdicate in favor of his son and become a hermit. But his wife, Shachi, was so upset that she asked Brihaspati, the lord of magic wisdom, to prevent her husband's departure. The old wizard explained to Indra that a spiritual life was all very well, but it didn't have to be at the expense of family life. Indra decided to remain with his wife as lord of the gods. Thus ends the story of how the king of the gods was humiliated in his boundless pride, cured of an excessive ambition, and through wisdom brought to a knowledge of his true role in the never-ending play of unending life.
Indians, therefore, have a very expansive notion of time. You don't have to have been there more than a few days to discover that. The Indian now means something a bit broader and more generous than our now, this minute, immediately. Short term in the United States means a few months. In India, a few years. For Americans, long-term planning involves anywhere from 1 to maybe 5 years. For Indians, maybe a couple of hundred years. Anita Desai is a novelist, a very good one, half German, half Bengali. Perhaps that's why she's so very much aware of these different notions of time.
Time is as small or as large as they want it to be. Yes, on the whole, I think time does slow down the minute one steps into India. One finds time slowing, the day being endlessly long, the nights being endlessly long. There's time for everything, to include everything. Whereas in the West, one is tremendously conscious of the brevity of time, the shortness of having to pack in so much into this very little time. This is not an Indian sensation at all.
For Indians, time is infinite and composed of endless cycles within cycles. The largest cycle is the Kalpa, or cosmic day, 400 billion years long. One Kalpa is just one day in the life of Brahma, the creator. In each cosmic day, Brahma recreates the universe. During the cosmic night, he sleeps. Within each cosmic day, there are smaller and shorter cycles, of which the smallest are the four yugas, or ages of man. This is where we come in. We're now in the fourth and final age of man, known as the Kali Yuga, which began, according to tradition, in 3102 BC, the year of the legendary Mahabharata War. The Kali Yuga is about as low as man can sink.
The destruction of the world will occur because of the departure from virtue and profit, little by little, day by day. Money alone will confer nobility. Power will be the sole definition of virtue. Pleasure will be the only reason for marriage. Lust will be the only reason for womanhood. Oppressed by their excessively greedy rulers, people will hide in valleys between mountains where they will gather honey, vegetables, roots, fruits, birds, flowers, and so forth. Suffering from cold, wind, heat, and rain, they will put on clothes made of tree bark and leaves. And no one will live as long as 23 years. Thus, in the Kali Yuga, humankind will be utterly destroyed.
Ultimate destruction takes a form familiar to Indians. First a drought, so severe that the earth will become as bare as a turtle's back. Then floods that last for 100 years. Before Brahma is born again from the lotus in Vishnu's navel. Now the average Indian probably doesn't know many of the numbers bandied about in these ancient texts. But he does carry within him a sense of time's vastness and his relationship to the history of mankind in a way that's probably foreign to us in the West. Many of the hymns from the Rig Veda are about those great imponderables, the immensity of our universe and the infinite mysteries of human existence. I don't know how many Indians actually know their Vedas, but I'd bet that almost every Indian's behavior is consciously or unconsciously based on their message. You'll find that message in the Upanishads, the core teachings of the Vedas. Spiritual freedom, or moksha, is to be reached through knowledge of self. The key to reality is not outside man, but within him. This is an extract from the Chandogya Upanishad. Sometimes I think I understand it. Other times I'm completely baffled.
Place this salt in this dish of water. In the morning, come back and see me.
He did as he was told and returned the next day.
That salt you placed in the dish last evening, please bring it here.
He looked for it but couldn't find it because it was completely dissolved.
Please take a sip from this end. What's it taste like?
Salt.
Take a sip from the middle. What's that taste like?
Salt.
Take a sip from the other end. And what does that taste of?
Salt. It's always the same.
Put it to one side, then come here. You didn't see the substance of the salt, but it's there, isn't it? That is its essence. That is reality. That is Atma. Tat Tvam Asi. That art thou.
If you say the words Indian philosophy to me, I see a string of instant clichés, saffron robes, endless chanting, incense, notions of passivity, nonviolence, renouncing worldly possessions, somehow living detached from this world. But one of the rather humbling things you learn about India is how often they've been there centuries before the West. I mean, what could be more up to date than the philosophy of materialism? Only that which I see can be real and therefore exist. Very modern. But the Indians had thought it through while we were still in caves and skins. Well, almost. Now, the average Indian doesn't go around spouting the Vedas or Jainism or materialist philosophies any more than you or I do. But these ideas become assimilated in the form of folk songs and fairy tales. Over the generations, they become part of the basic makeup of the average Indian. Indian philosophers also have this characteristic of being infinitely elastic. They seem reluctant to reach definitive judgments. Right and wrong are never distinct and separate. Evil and good coexist. Imagine this carried over into the behavior of Indians. It's most disconcerting.
The Indian mind also believes that any formulation, any determinate statement, is bound to be only partially correct. It will be both incomplete and also partially false.
For centuries, millions of ordinary Indians have found comfort and guidance in the Bhagavad Gita, one chapter in the mammoth epic, the Mahabharata. The Gita was Gandhi's favorite book, and it's formed the basis of works by people as diverse as Henry Thoreau and Philip Glass. The Gita is also known as Krishna's Counsel in Time of War. It consists of a conversation between the warrior Arjun and his charioteer, the god Krishna. Arjun is faced with an awful choice: fight and kill his relatives and friends, or be killed himself. Krishna tells him that one must perform one's sacred duty, even if it involves violence and bloodshed.
Look to your own duty. Do not tremble before it. Nothing is better for a warrior than a battle of sacred duty. The doors of heaven open for warriors who rejoice to have a battle like this thrust on them by chance. If you fail to wage this war of sacred duty, you will abandon your own duty and fame, only to gain evil.
Krishna explains to Arjun that true freedom lies in doing one's sacred duty or dharma, regardless of reward or punishment, pleasure or pain, life or death. The highest action is that which has the least regard for results or consequences. Any action is better than no action or renunciation of the world.
Better to do one's own duty imperfectly than to do another's well. Doing action intrinsic to his being, a man avoids guilt. You are bound by your own action, intrinsic to your being, Arjuna. Even against your will, you must do what delusion now makes you refuse.
The Gita certainly didn't start off as a central religious text, but over the centuries, as Hinduism evolved, it has been teased out of the Mahabharata to the point where, for many, it is the supreme teaching and guide to daily conduct. The other great epic, the Ramayana, may not have any one passage so concentrated or powerful as the Gita, but it also is omnipresent in the lives of millions of Indians, literate and illiterate, cutting across regions, gender and class.
Suno das mukh khagot prakasa, kavon ki nalani karain vikasa, asman samaj kahet jaan ki, khal sudhi ne ragubir baan ki, sat sune hari aanahin
hoi. Mrs. Swaran Baljit Singh lives in Lucknow, about 400 miles east of Delhi. Every morning after taking her bath, she recites a chapter from the Ramayana for about 45 minutes. It takes her about a month to recite the whole book from start to finish.
To what extent is a story like the Ramayana just a story or something more to you?
It is not a story. It leaves a great impact in your character and the daily ways of your life. Your conscience really pricks you if you sort of go not to follow this, if you really believe in it.
सीता ते मम कृत अपमाना कटियों तब सिर कठिन कृपाना नाई ते सपद भान मम बानी.
In the Ramayana, the wicked demon Ravana abducts Sita, the wife of Rama, the perfect man. In this morning's chapter, Ravana tries to force Sita to marry him. She refuses with a cutting insult.
The lotus always comes out when there is sun. It never comes out when there is a small light, like a jugnu, which is a little animal which gives light. So you are like a jugnu and sun is like Ram. So the lotus always smiles before the sun. And so you are just a little insect in front of me. And I just can't marry you.
These stories have been passed down through more than 2,000 years by storytellers. India may not be a literate country in the formal sense of the word, but orally, it's tremendously cultured. In each village, even within each compound, there's usually one grandparent to tell these stories to the children when they return home from school or the fields. One afternoon in a poor village in Bihar, near where Sita, the heroine of the Ramayana, is supposed to have been born maybe 3,000 years ago, we eavesdropped as a Brahmin widow gathered her grandchildren around her to tell the story of Ram and Sita's wedding. She sat on a little mud platform. That morning it had been freshly smeared with liquid cow dung. The ammonia content in the dung acts as a disinfectant. At each corner of the platform, four poles supported a shade of palm leaves against the afternoon sun. A dozen young children gathered with a hushed sense of expectancy at hearing yet again a much-loved tale.
Out in the country in India, the day begins early. One sees a vast plain, perfectly flat, dust-colored and brickyardy, stretching limitlessly away on every side in the dim gray light, striped everywhere with hard-beaten narrow paths, the vast flatness broken at wide intervals by bunches of spectral trees that mark where villages are.
Often it seems that nothing has changed in the Indian countryside since Mark Twain wrote this passage almost a century ago.
And along all the paths are slender women and the black forms of lanky naked men moving to their work. The women with brass water jars on their heads, the men carrying hoes. The man is not entirely naked. Always there is a bit of white rag, a loincloth. It amounts to a bandage and is a white accent on his black person, like the silver band around the middle of a pipe stem.
And in much of the Indian countryside, this is still the abiding image that the Western mind takes back and treasures, a memory perhaps of how our ancestors must once have worked and lived the land.
All day long, one has this monotony of dust-colored dead levels and scattering bunches of trees and mud villages. You soon realize that India is not beautiful. Still, there is an enchantment about it that is beguiling and which does not pall. You cannot tell just what it is that makes the spell, perhaps, but you feel it and confess it.
One of the great and enduring journalistic clichés about India is how nothing has changed in the villages and small towns for the past 2,000 years. Even Twain fell victim to this cliché of India unchanging from time immemorial.
Nevertheless, at bottom, you know in a vague way that it is history. It is that that affects you. A haunting sense of the myriads of human lives that have blossomed and withered and perished here. Repeating and repeating and repeating, century after century and age after age. The barren and meaningless process. It is this sense that gives to this forlorn, uncomely land power to speak to the spirit and make friends with it. To speak to it with a voice bitter with satire, but eloquent with melancholy.
Thirty years ago, Indian economist Kusum Nair traveled throughout rural India to discover why so many development projects seemed to be failing. In much of the countryside, she found that the tradition of "that's the way it's always been" was still the overwhelming attitude. In the southern state of Karnataka, she met Ballappa, a landless agricultural laborer, smoking a bidi or cheap Indian cigarette, when he should have been out working the fields.
How is it that you're back so early? Aren't you going to work for the rest of the day?
No.
Why?
I am tired.
How much have you been paid for half a day's work?
1.5 sers of jowar.
But are you able to get work all the year round so that you can afford to take it easy?
No.
Then what do you do when you have no work?
Sit at home and borrow and eat. What else can I do?
Why don't you work for the whole day when work is available and save for lean times?
Oh, I have to get grass for the cow. If I work in the afternoon as well, when will I get the grass for the cow?
Peasants refused to irrigate their land to grow two crops unless the rains failed. They insisted on plowing with bullocks instead of tractors, because that was the way it had always been done. But in other parts of the country, especially the Punjab, Naya found peasants only too willing to throw over tradition and embrace progress and prosperity. Mohinder's father fled Pakistan in 1947 and was given land in a ruined village near the city of Ludhiana. Almost the first thing he did, as Mohinder explains, was to buy a tractor.
Because with bullocks there are so many limitations. Almost half the land goes for growing fodder. That is what my father was preaching to these people, that small farmers should not farm with bullocks. If I have 5 acres and I keep bullocks, 2 acres will be allotted for fodder. So only 3 acres are left to me. What will I do with 3 acres? So my father said that only big farmers can afford to maintain bullocks, not small farmers. And then you see, we had to study at the same time. With bullocks you have to work the whole day. With the tractor, when we came home in the evening, in 2 hours we could cultivate all the land or do whatever else was required.
In fact, there was always change in the countryside. Many of the essentials, such as salt or metal, were brought into the village by traveling salesmen. Towns depended on villages for a supply of fresh food. Pilgrimages meant visitors passing through.
There weren't these walls between urban and rural India. Most of us, even men like me, were brought up in a village, born in a village, brought up in a village, moved to a town. The constant coming and going, that's the upper crust where you had the means of traveling. And in the same village there are others who were born there and lived there and died there, and for them nothing changed.
Though little may have changed since the writer Khushwant Singh was a boy, in the past 20 years, technology and consumer goods have become common in most villages. Loki Madan, a professor in Delhi University, first went to a village in Kashmir in the late 1950s.
The village had no electricity, it had no tapped water. There were a village of 2,500 people. There were exactly 2 radios in the village, mine and one family had it. To get to the village, I had to do the last 2 miles on foot, and in winter, the last 4 miles on foot. Now there are buses running through the village, there's water in the taps, which is not necessarily a good thing. And there is electricity in the village. And somewhere around, let us say, mid-60s, the village had a community listening center with a radio and so on.
20 years later, Madan returned to the same village and found that the community radio had disappeared.
So I asked the village headman what happened to it. He said, well, the government people came and made a census of radios in the village. And they found there were more radios in the village than households. And so they took the community listening center radio away.
But the novelist Anita Desai isn't buying this idea of change.
If you see how people have lived, there's never any great change from how they've lived for centuries before. On a superficial level, things do change. Mechanical gadgets do come in to a certain extent and people do travel more. But on the whole, no one ever breaks away from that repetitive pattern. The design always remains the same, partly because no one ever dares break it. It's hallowed by tradition and by custom. No one would dare make a true break in it.
On the face of it, Anita Desai's pessimism seems overdone. In many parts of the country, there's a lot of upward mobility, particularly among the young. The old rigidities appear to be fading, largely thanks to education. Sons of farmers become computer programmers, the sons of shopkeepers, professors. But underneath, have their attitudes and values changed? Scratch off the shiny enamel. Underneath, the past is still there, doing pretty nicely, thank you. One interesting example, how many Indian students are really willing to choose their own husband or wife? Apparently not many. Modern Indians still value the traditional arranged marriage. The past is in fact everywhere. The past is indeed everywhere. If you think that's something negative, take the case of the most famous Indian of them all, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, the Mahatma, the father of modern India. Gandhi was born in a traditional Banya or merchant caste family in the western state of Gujarat. His father was the chief minister in a small princely state on the coast.
You see, in my view, one of the chief things to note in Gandhiji's life is that he was not born great. He was not born with things which usually help people to become great.
The late Dr. Zakir Hussain was India's third president after independence.
He was born an ordinary man with ordinary capacities, and he literally hammered himself into shape. He chiseled himself into shape, he hammered himself into shape, as the case arose. He was a self-educated, self-made man, consciously determined to make himself an instrument of the values which he prized.
Although not immediately, because as a young man, Gandhi was initially tempted to become an anglicized Indian lawyer in London. It was only when he reached South Africa and first came into contact with white racism that Gandhi abandoned his plans to become a little Englishman and looked for answers and values elsewhere. He found them in the ascetic traditions of non-violence and self-denial of his native Gujarat. If the Indian peasants were to be aroused, Gandhi realized he must identify directly with them. Soon after he returned to India for good in 1915, he was arrested by the British. In Richard Attenborough's film, Gandhi's friend, the English clergyman Charles Andrews, visits him in prison and finds him dressed only in a white cotton dhoti, or loincloth.
Did they take your clothes?
These are my clothes now. If I want to be one with them, I have to live like them.
Yes, I think you do, but...
Gandhi later explained this in a letter written in 1921 and read here by Harsh Nayyar.
Unless I went about with a loincloth, how might I advise others to do likewise? What should I do where millions have to go naked? The dress of the millions of agriculturists in India is really only the loincloth and nothing more. I have seen it with my own eyes wherever I have gone.
in the language which he spoke and the persona which he projected, he used a lot of the symbolism of Indian civilization.
Dr. Ravinder Kumar is the director of the Nehru Memorial Library in Delhi. In Indian culture, the ruler who can overcome material attachment and self-interest is alone considered capable of ruling in the self-interest of others.
There is a great historicity in Indian civilization of the supreme moral actor through his example, which ripples through the social order, generating great waves of human action, you know. Now, I think it was this tradition of moral action which Gandhi appropriated and transplanted it on the political domain. And for this reason, he was able to create the sort of unity in our country on an anti-imperialist platform, the like of which I think nobody has achieved in this country before him or has probably achieved after him.
Like many another great leader, he did it by using methods that would restore Indian self-confidence. As Gandhi says in Attenborough's film,
I have to be sure, they have to be sure that what we do can be done by Indians alone.
And this is what Gandhi did. Gandhi had been doing this experiment through all his life because India was a slave country. And everything which came from Britain was great. But what Gandhi did, Gandhi started that non-cooperation movement and boycott movement.
Sundarlal Bahugana is an environmentalist living in the Himalayas who's been greatly influenced by Gandhi's economic ideas of self-sufficiency.
He said, you boycott everything which is coming from foreign countries and you have to spin your own cloth and you have to make your all things. He started the Swadeshi movement just in order to create self-confidence among the people. And he went to the extent that every village should be self-sufficient in its basic needs.
He did it essentially by following the lesson of the Bhagavad Gita, that right means are always more important than the end, no matter how just and desired that end may be.
It is the one book open to every Hindu who will care to study it. And if all the other scriptures were reduced to ashes, the 700 verses of this imperishable booklet are quite enough to tell one what Hinduism is and how one can live up to it.
Through the Gita and the other great epic, the Ramayana, Gandhi was speaking in the language and imagery of the ordinary Indian. The lower castes in particular could identify with the compassion of both Rama and Krishna for the poor and with their implicit criticism of the upper castes. In the novel Kantapura, set in the 1920s in a village in South India, the author Raja Rao takes this one step further. To spread Gandhi's message, a supporter tells some villagers that the gods have decided to send a reincarnation of the supreme god Vishnu down to earth to rid India of British colonialism.
There was born in a family in Gujarat a son such as the world has never beheld. As soon as he came forth, the four wide walls began to shine like the kingdom of the sun, and hardly was he in the cradle than he began to lisp the language of wisdom. You remember how Krishna, when he was but a babe of four, had begun to fight against demons and had killed the serpent Kali. So too, our Mohandas began to fight against the enemies of the country. And as he grew up, and after he was duly shaven for the hair ceremony, he began to go out into the villages and talk to them. And his voice was so pure, his forehead so brilliant with wisdom, that men followed him, more and more men followed him as they did Krishna, the flute player. And so he goes from village to village to slay the serpent of the foreign rule. And he says too, spin every day. Spin and weave every day, for our mother is in tattered weeds, and a poor mother needs clothes to cover her sores. If you spin, he says, the money that goes to the red man will stay within your country, and the mother can feed the foodless and the milkless and the clothless. He is a saint, the Mahatma, a wise man and a soft man and a saint.
The means chosen by Gandhi to secure independence were typically Indian. Gandhi saw that loyal constitutionalism and terrorist violence had failed. He advocated satyagraha, or truth force. In practice, this meant using the moral power which comes from holding fast to the truth to achieve political ends. It also shamed the British into recognizing the injustice of their colonial rule.
What Mr. Gandhi has forced us to do is ask questions about ourselves. As Christians, those are difficult questions to answer. How do we treat men who defy an unjust law, who will not fight, but will not comply? As Christians...
The method Gandhi chose was civil disobedience and non-violence, or ahimsa, both traditional cultural forms for resolving conflicts and opposing unjust rulers. The film Gandhi contains a dramatized scene that shows how ahimsa could bring the British Empire in India to a complete standstill.
If I may, I for one have never advocated passive anything. And I think our resistance must be active and provocative. I want to embarrass all those who wish to treat us as slaves. I want to change their minds, not kill them for weaknesses we all possess.
And what resistance would you offer?
The law is due to take effect from April the 6th. I want to call upon the nation to make that a day of prayer and fasting.
You mean a general strike?
I mean a day of prayer and fasting. Of course, no work could be done. No buses, no trains, no factories, no administration. The country would stop.
My God, it would terrify them. 350 million people at prayer. Even the English newspapers would have to report that and explain why.
But could we get people to do it?
Ahimsa involved a reverence for life and is a notion with a long religious history going back to the teachings of Mahavira, the founder of Jainism. Unsurprisingly, the center of Jainism is in Gujarat. For Gandhi, ahimsa meant fighting evil by doing good deeds in the world. It did not mean meekness or passivity.
Without ahimsa, it is not possible to seek and find truth. Ahimsa and truth are so intertwined that it is practically impossible to disentangle and separate them. Nevertheless, ahimsa is the means and truth is the end. If we take care of the means, we are bound to reach the end sooner or later. If we resolve to do this, we shall have won the battle.
Non-violence lends itself to something that can be done all the time, anyway.
Vandana Shiva is an environmentalist and a feminist who lives and works in the foothills of the Himalayas.
To me, it captures what I see as very valuable in India. The really quiet power, but a very strong power of the feminine force, as you call it. A force that fights while living.
Woman is the incarnation of ahimsa. Ahimsa means infinite love, which again means infinite capacity for suffering. Has she not greater intuition? Is she not more self-sacrificing? Has she not greater powers of endurance? Has she not greater courage?
Gandhi thought women nobler than men, and better qualified to teach the art of peace to the warring world. But did that make Gandhi a feminist?
For him, women were the object of humanitarian concern, not individual in their own right, while feminism means accepting individuality of a woman.
Vibhuti Patel heads Forum Against Rape, an organization based in Bombay. She believes that Gandhi only partially managed to free himself from traditional Indian notions of how women think and behave.
He opposed parda. He brought them to the national mainstream for nationalist movement. He used his charisma to draw thousands of women in a public life. But he wanted women's contribution as mothers and sisters, not as individual in their own right. Even for his long march, Salt Satyagraha, he didn't want women. It was Sarojini Naidu, Hansa Mehta, and all of them defied and forcibly joined the march. Gandhiji didn't want women to come for those kind of militant action.
Gandhi had a curious notion that only men derive pleasure from sex, and that women's interest in sex was purely submissive and self-sacrificing.
I have believed in woman's perfect equality with man. My wife was inferior when she was the instrument of my lust. She ceased to be that when she lay with me naked as my sister.
As part of his experiment with self-control, Gandhi took a vow to become a brahmachari, or celibate, when he was 35 years old. Interestingly enough, he never discussed this with his wife, Kasturba. The first she knew of it was when he announced that they would no longer have sexual relations together. If Gandhi was both radical and reactionary in his attitudes towards women, he was more firmly a prisoner of very traditional ideas about India's future economic course. Like the early utopian socialists in Europe, Gandhi rejected Western industrial society. His solution was an agrarian revolution and a return to a simple, worthwhile life in self-contained rural communities. The symbol was the chakra, or spinning wheel. For Gandhi, this was the only realistic type of economic development for a country of India's size.
The only way to solve the most crucial problem of unemployment is self-employment by the villagers. The government or the modern industry is never going to be able to give jobs or wage-based work to the millions of people in faraway remote villages.
Nandini Joshi is a Harvard-trained economist who now lives in Ahmedabad in Gujarat. Nandini is a firm believer in Gandhian economics and has begun a project to revive Gandhi's idea that villagers should spin their own cloth.
For villages to retain their freedom, it's absolutely very essential that they produce their basic needs of food and cloth themselves. Otherwise, they would be subjugated to others. They would be dominated by the others. Actually, he thought of India as a republic where the villages themselves are individual republics.
For many people, Gandhi's name is synonymous with the plight of the lowest elements of Indian society, the so-called untouchables, who were the victims of a form of apartheid every bit as degrading as its African equivalent.
I believe that if untouchability is really rooted out, it will not only purge Hinduism of a terrible blot, but its repercussions will be worldwide. My fight against untouchability is a fight against the impure in humanity.
In everything he said and did, Gandhi sought to identify with the untouchables. However, contrary to what most people probably believe, he did not set out to abolish the caste system. His thoughts are full of contradictions.
I have frequently said, I do not believe in caste in the modern sense. It is an excrescence and a handicap to progress. Nor do I believe in inequalities between human beings. We are all absolutely equal. I do, however, believe in Varna, which is based on hereditary occupations. I consider the four caste divisions alone to be fundamental, natural, and essential. I am certainly against any attempt at destroying these fundamental divisions. I believe that caste has saved Hindustan from disintegration.
Thank you. For many Orthodox Brahmins, Gandhi's championing of the untouchables, along with his persistent attempt to bend over backwards to treat Muslims as equals of the majority Hindus, were acts of heresy. In this recording made in Pune in 1934, one of his prayer meetings was disrupted when a bomb was thrown at Gandhi. Gandhi's comments are read from a letter he sent after the incident.
I have nothing but deep pity for the unknown thrower of the bomb. Let the reformers not be incensed against the bomb thrower or those who may be behind him. What I should like them to do is to redouble their efforts to rid the country of the deadly evil of untouchability.
Gandhi's was a complex personality full of contradictions. In many respects, he was a prisoner of the past. His economic ideas, for instance, were quickly discarded after independence. Winston Churchill dismissed Gandhi as a half-naked fakir. But if Gandhi had stuck to pinstripe suits and the lifestyle of a westernized lawyer, he'd probably be just a footnote in some obscure history book. Through his choice of symbols and values, Gandhi demonstrated that the past may also contain the seeds of revolution and freedom.
At the stroke of the midnight hour, when the world sleeps, India will awake to life and freedom.
Though the crowd chanted his name, Gandhi was not celebrating. Freedom was not a sufficient end in itself. He was in Calcutta, yet again fasting to bring an end to Hindu-Muslim bloodshed.
To give a message, appealing to the West, it must be a message of love. It must be a message of truth.
The presence of the past was written and produced by Julian Crandall-Hollick and Dean Capello. The production assistants in India were Rana Behl, Raja Chatterjee and Raj Shekharan. The actors were A.K. Ramanujan, Harsh Nair, Arjun Sajnani, Aarti Rao and Bill MacDonald. The theme and other original music were composed and performed by Shubha Shankaran. Consultants to this program were Philip Oldenburg of Columbia University, T.N. Madan of the Institute of Economic Growth, and Ashish Nandi of the Center for the Study of Developing Societies. For more information about cassette copies of this series, please phone 1-800-854-TAPE during regular business hours. Passages to India is a production of IBA, Independent Broadcasting Associates, and is made possible with major grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Rockefeller Foundation. Support for the national distribution of this program is provided by this and other national public radio member stations and by the NPR Cultural Program Fund. Contributors include the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, connecting artists and communities worldwide. I'm Deepika Roy. This is NPR, National Public Radio.